Boise.
Yes, I'm very excited.
We shouldn't say Boise.
Ontario and Vail, anyway.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. I'd like to open the interim House Energy and Environment Committee for Tuesday, November 17th, 2015. And I am going to open, welcome everyone. We're going to open an informational meeting, which is invited testimony only. We're going to get started today. We have environmental justice issues that we're going to be talking about, the report on community solar that was a result of the bill that came out of this committee, House Bill 2941. Talk about the Northwest Conservation and Energy Power Plan, which is being drafted right now, and then finish up with an update on the Federal Clean Power Plan and how that work is doing. So to start off with the EJ issues, I'm going to call up Reverend Joseph Santos Lyons, Mary Pivido, and Joe Eboa. So thank you all for being here today. I just want to remind you to introduce yourself for the record when you get started. And we do have two panels of folks who are going to speak, so if you could keep your remarks to about 5 minutes, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much. So thank you so much, Chair Peterson, members of the committee. My name is Joseph Santos Lyons. I'm the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, or APANO. I'm also a proud member of the Governor's Environmental Justice Task Force, and I come to you with those hats on today. I just want to begin by really thanking Chair Peterson and the committee for convening this important briefing on environmental justice, and thank all my colleagues here today who will speak on a range of issues about the experiences, challenges, and opportunities that low-income communities and communities of color face throughout Oregon. Environmental justice is the fair treatment and equal protection of communities of color and low-income communities in decisions that affect our quality of life in the places and spaces where we live, work, play, and pray. It is about ensuring opportunities for meaningful participation in decision-making, and at the community level, it is about empowerment and self-determination. EJ, or environmental justice, is not just one more thing to consider. It is about basic fairness, and it is a better, more equitable way of doing business. Advancing environmental justice in Oregon is about making Oregon economically stronger, healthier, and more resilient for the challenges that lie ahead. After years of hard work and service by Senator Avell Gordley, the legislature created the task force in 2007 to accomplish three objectives. First, we advised the governor and their staff about EJ issues across the state. Second, we worked with the natural resource agencies to help them better understand and incorporate EJ into their programs and actions. And third, we connect with EJ communities across the state to ensure their voices are heard. The task force meets in Portland, we've met in Medford, and we are continuing our work as a joint task force with the governor. Since 2008, we draft an annual report outlining our important issues in the state and the ways Oregon has met those challenges, along with some missed opportunities. We've engaged communities to advance our Your Voice for EJ document, which articulates our values and gives the community an opportunity to be heard and engaged. We held our most recent meeting in Medford, which I know my colleagues here will talk more about, working with partners to create space to hear from farm workers about their exposure to pesticides, working conditions, and more. We wish to do more in our position as the EJ Task Force, and we are continuing to seek the resources to do so and the partnerships to make it happen. We're very grateful to the governor's staff in helping secure the minimal funding to facilitate the work that we do around the state. Most of what we focused on over the last 3 years and where we can make more of a difference is working directly with state agencies. We know low-income communities and communities of color are disproportionately burdened by a range of environmental health risks, including air toxics, workplace hazards, and they lack the same access to benefits such as transportation alternatives and safe housing. Our goal in working with agencies is to shift the way that we operate EJ is not just about public process and participation. Agencies are required by federal law and some state laws to understand the implications of their actions on the communities that are low-income and communities of color, and take steps to mitigate those impacts. To ensure that agencies are building a greater expertise and incorporating EJ into their programs, there are new efforts to establish cultural competency norms for area managers, helping do one-on-one work with liaisons to understand EJ, and to convene sessions to look at the data and GIS mapping to help us understand the context in which we operate. Our top priority moving forward is to increase the accountability of agencies and efforts to advance EJ. The task force won the EPA National Achievement Award in 2011 for our work developing expertise with agency management and cultural competency, but so far only DEQ has fully implemented these internally, and we expect all state agencies to follow suit. We will also continue to focus on increasing outreach and engagement with our communities. We'll continue to work with the state advocacy commissions, the Black Affairs, Hispanic Affairs, Latino, Native, and the Women's Commissions. And finally, you know, as legislature looks to taking on new climate change policy over the next year or two, we have several sort of principles we want to lift up for you as you think about this decision making. You know, climate change is a significant issue that many states are taking leadership on, including Oregon. And we want to ensure that our communities are directly at the table in crafting those solutions. And that climate justice, you know, really means that the communities that are most affected have a say in what the solution looks like. Any statewide climate action must be designed and led through an inclusive process. And the solutions must do more than just hold our communities harmless. It must be about making investments and redressing the history of harms that our communities have faced or will face because of the climate issues that are happening here in the state. I want to thank you so much for the opportunity to testify and turn it over to my colleagues, and happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Joseph.
Thank you, and thank you, Chair Vega Peterson, and all the members of the committee. I really appreciate this opportunity to speak. My name is Mary Pivato, and I'm the president of Neighbors for Clean Air. This organization has been devoted to addressing the huge gap between what is a safe and healthy environment for every Oregonian and our current federal and state regulations around air emissions. There's two reasons why unmitigated toxic air pollution in Portland is a problem and why it is an environmental justice issue. The first example is one that we're very well known for, being able to negotiate and come to an agreement directly with a large industrial polluter in the Northwest neighborhood around my daughter's school, Chapman Elementary. But I'd like you to consider another school, Cesar Chavez in North Portland. Very much like my daughter's school, has an industrial air pollution problem that's caused by the heavy metal, the metals and steel production in the Portland metro area. It was also ranked in the bottom 2% in the nation for all the schools across the country that were at most risk for industrial air pollution. Like my daughter's school, these heavy metals are bioaccumulative. They come into the environment and they really stay there unless, as I've been told by a lot of public health folks, that they're carried out usually on our body. But that's kind of where the similarities end. If you consider in the last 5 years since we addressed this problem in the Northwest neighborhood, ESCO Steel, due to a good neighbor agreement, negotiated directly, has committed $5 million in emission reduction efforts at their plant. And they've also committed to $25,000 to monitor the air at Chapman School. And that's kind of where the similarities end. At Cesar Chavez in North Portland, you've seen no effort to assess or mitigate the risk for the children. And really, the only difference is in the makeup of the community. Because at Cesar Chavez, you have 80% of the students qualify for free and reduced lunch, which is our typical poverty indicator, as well as 70% come from non-English speaking families. And when you leave the regulation of air emissions to a do-it-yourself model, but with communities that don't have the legal and technical resources to address these huge problems, you really have a very unjust system. The second point that I'd like to speak to you today, though, is really about the same gaps in federal and state regulations leave an even bigger killer in the Oregon air, and that is around diesel particulate matter. The black soot and gases released from diesel tailpipes include a cocktail of over 40 toxic substances, far more toxic than exhaust from gasoline. Besides endangering human health, diesel engines emit black carbon, which is a potent global warming pollutant. And here are just a few of the facts in Oregon. Oregon is the sixth highest in the nation for health risk from diesel pollution, and it costs our state $3.5 billion in public health costs every year. 17 Oregon counties have diesel pollution at levels that are considered harmful. In fact, Multnomah County ranks fourth in concentration of diesel exhaust among all U.S. counties in the U.S. 96% of Oregonians will have an elevated cancer risk from diesel in their lifetime. Children and elderly are especially vulnerable. But finally, most relevant to today's discussion, the 2014 Multnomah County Report on Ethnic and Racial Disparities found that people of color in the county are exposed to 2 to 3 times higher diesel levels of diesel particulates than whites. Exposure to diesel is highest in census tracts with the highest concentration of African American residents, who also experience some of the highest rates of asthma and other diseases associated with air pollution. Unlike a single source, this is emitted widely across the state from multiple mobile, stationary sources, on-road and off-road. It is the largest engine employed in the business of moving freight and in construction. Federal rules have focused on engine manufacturing standards, but leave the regulation of existing engines up to states. The good news is that engines that meet today's EPA standards will reduce 95 to 99% of the toxic and most harmful emissions. But the bad news is that Oregon is the only state on the West Coast that has no regulations prohibiting the use of older engines. This is most pronounced as we continue to see data support that our state is becoming the dumping ground for the nearly 1 million vehicles and engines that have been outlawed in California. Do-it-yourself air emissions projects cannot take on a problem of this scale. Our communities need legislative action to effectively mitigate this public health hazard. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, my name is Jolie Boa. I am here representing Beyond Toxics as the Environmental Justice and Community Outreach Manager. When most folks think of environmental justice, what comes to mind is urban communities, usually low-income people of color, who are facing industrial facilities and environmental hazards in the form of pollution to the air and water. This is usually the standard for environmental justice and environmental justice community. However, it's also important to know that many of these folks who are vulnerable, who live in these communities, not only live there, but also may work at the very same facilities. Meaning the thing that is killing them is also providing food for their children and for themselves. If they don't work in these industrial facilities, they may work nearby in places in the environment that we would deem would provide air and a clean environment. I'm of course speaking about folks who work in the agricultural sector or in forestry. Unfortunately, these folks oftentimes are exposed to chemicals and their voice is unheard. On September 25th, Beyond Toxics and four partnering organizations invited the Governor's Environmental Justice Task Force to an event. This is the first time in the 8 years that the EJ Task Force has been in existence that they have left the Capitol into a community, and this event happened in Bedford. Justice for the Land of the Worker, which is what we called it, happened because our partners wanted to bring the issue of chemical exposure in the form of pesticides and herbicides to the Oregon Environmental Justice Task Force. These people take care of our forests and harvest the food that we eat every single day. At Justice for the Land and the Worker, we heard from 12 people And these 12 people were heard by task force members as well as state agencies who are required to come to these meetings. 12 people who work in the environment. 12 people with hopes, families, and dreams. The majority of them working in agriculture and forestry. I'm going to talk about two of the testimonies I heard today to give you a little taste of what it is that we heard. The first woman who spoke was an indigenous woman from Mexico. She was promoted to mixing chemicals at a nursery. This woman was pregnant with child. Many of us here have had, or will have, or know someone currently who is pregnant. The thought of my sister, cousins, being exposed to chemicals day after day because they have to mix chemicals at a nursery, to me, is uncomfortable, if not downright appalling. Still, she continued day after day, mixing these chemicals and going home with terrible headaches and nausea. She asked her boss if she could leave because she felt that something was very, very wrong with her pregnancy. He said no, because she was the only one who can mix the chemicals at her job site. 2 weeks later, she ended up in the ER. Her baby had been dead for 2 weeks, and she was told that she had a very serious uterine infection. In fact, her doctors told her it was so serious, had she waited another day, she would be dead. The second story is of two sisters. They recounted the story of their father who worked in forestry. After being sickened by exposure to herbicides in the workplace, he spent a week in the hospital. Afterwards, his older daughter spent 3 months nursing him back to health. All the while, his medical bills were accumulating. The company was refusing to acknowledge that it was because of his work that he ended up in the hospital and was so sick, and he had rashes and boils all over his body. To add to that, the doctor that the company sent him to said that it happened because of bug bites. These stories that I heard and many more were incredulous to me. It seems as if they aren't of this planet. But it's important to know that these people's lived experiences make them experts on environmental justice. And their experiences make them qualified and deserving to have a platform. A platform to find solutions for their problems. I believe they should be on committees, work groups, many where decisions are made around the workplace and exposure to chemicals. This is what environmental justice is all about. I challenge you, think about who on your work groups you appoint. Ask yourself, are the right people at the table? The most vulnerable, the most affected by these problems have to have a seat at the table. Without them, the meaningful and just solutions that we need, the lasting impact that we would want, cannot be achieved. I challenge you, provide leadership to protect our workers by introducing legislation and pass laws that will reduce vulnerabilities and exposure to pesticides and herbicides. Our workers deserve this. They are the backbone of our economy. They are the most vulnerable, and they deserve better. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel?
I guess that briefly.
Yep.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate your testimony for you being here today. Are you aware of the agricultural worker protection standard that the EPA just released in October?
Yes, the around chemical exposure?
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
Could you comment on that?
And yeah, of
feel
course.
That might dovetail with some of the comments that you made. I mean, the question I guess I would ask is, as the feds are working in this area, I guess it would be perhaps more better for industry, better for agriculture, if there's one set of rules that all farmers right. and everybody are playing by. So just tell me what your opinions, I guess, are on the new rules that have been released and if they are helping to address some of the concerns that you brought up.
It's interesting because, you know, I'm thinking back on the New Deal, you know, when they passed child protection laws, there was kind of touted as this incredible thing. And if you take a look at, we took a critical look at that the document, which is several hundred pages, so that was that was fun. But it seems as if The standards that were passed were much needed because it hasn't been revised in the last 20 years, but I still don't think they are enough in the sense that, you know, the minimum, they didn't have a minimum age to be able to spray pesticides, which was a big concern for me. And now it's, they implemented one now, and I think it's 16.
I think it's 18.
You know, as it, and it seems like that's, you know, you look at these rules, you're like, wow, great. What else? And that's a general sense I get from this bill, from this piece from the EPA. There's also some certain components that I think are concerning in the sense that they are beginning to create a lot of documents, increased training. You know, beforehand, it was for pesticide application. I believe it was every 5 years you were expected to have a training, and now it's every year. And of course, there's a component in there about increased sort of bookkeeping around when pesticides are applicated. But there's also the big concern around, you know, the personnel protective equipment. What I heard at the EJ task force from our partners as well was that there is laws in place currently. The problem is enforcement. Mm-hmm. The enforcement of the laws. And the laws are there to protect people for a reason, and that looks great on paper, but if we still have incidents of chemical exposure to workers, then there's a problem there. And there was a big sort of concern I heard from some of our partners as well in a recent conversation we had about the fines. That the fines that are implemented when these things do come to justice, when they do come to the attention of OSHA, BOLI, whoever the agency may be, the Department of Agriculture, the penalties for violating the laws are not as severe as my partners think they should be.
All right. Thank you both very much. We have one more panel here. And just so the committee knows, Reverend Sanchez Lyons had a commitment at 2:30 that he had to leave for, so he wasn't trying to avoid anyone's questions. Next, we have Vivian Satterfield and Stephanie Knoll.
Chairwoman Vega Peterson and members of the House Energy and Environment Committee, good afternoon. Thank you for the invitation to address the committee today on a topic that is very important to me both personally and professionally. My name is Vivian Satterfield, and I am the Deputy Director of OPAL Environmental Justice Oregon. We call it OPAL for short. So OPAL builds power for environmental justice and civil rights in our communities. We develop leadership within low-income communities and communities of color around issues of environmental, racial, and social justice through grassroots organizing and policy advocacy. OPAL was established in 2006 to expand environmental justice organizing across the city of Portland, county, and our broader region, with an initial focus on East Portland, which I know the representative, Vega Peterson and Reardon, are well familiar with, and which is the fastest-growing and most diverse area of the city of Portland. OPAL's board, staff, and volunteers are diverse and representative of our target communities, including people of color, immigrants, working class, people with disabilities, youth, and the elderly. In the state of Oregon and in the city of Portland, we've had an unpleasant history with environmental injustice in regards to our low-income communities and communities of color. Policies such as and practices such as redlining, urban renewal, and gentrification have displaced many families in fractured communities. East Portland, for example, lacks basic infrastructure, paved roads, sidewalks, street lighting, and connected roadways. It also lacks basic amenities such as frequent transit, parks, and healthy food choices. Compounding these disparities, East Portland is home to the highest concentration and density of young people under the age of 18, increasingly from low-income families of color. Much of the work that OPAL does centrals around the urban environmental justice issues, so transportation, housing, and overall health. I'll talk a little bit about transportation. Transportation inequities result from inequitable processes. Just to give some context, the U.S. spends $60 billion with a B per year on our country's transportation systems, with ODOT and TriMet locally managing and spending hundreds of millions more. How these dollars are spent, who has access to the amenities, who gets the jobs, and who participates in the planning process are all critical equity concerns. A few more numbers, if you'll bear with me. Just to maintain transit service levels proportional to population growth, Oregon agencies need $364 million more in annual funding. Transit operations is the funding type that transit agencies currently say they need the most. That's transportation operations, pardon me. Here in Oregon, the state contributes only 3% of operations funding, compared with state contribution of over 24% nationally. This is especially critical to understand as we plan for projects that qualify for matching federal funds, like the Powell Division Bus Rapid Transit Project, with which myself and Chair Vega Peterson serve as members on the steering committee of. Transit is a lifeline for many people and can mean the difference between a job, safe housing, education, and access to services and recreation. The goal of making transportation more efficient is not to move people farther and faster, but to offer more options and greater access to all the amenities necessary for a healthy life: jobs, education, family, recreation. And while we're all impacted by transportation decisions, some residents of the metro region, particularly our constituencies, are disproportionately burdened by the inequities of our transportation system, which is why since 2012, OPAL's been organizing our Bus Riders Unite BRU membership base, designed to build leadership within these transit-dependent populations and achieve real transit equity in the TriMet service region. We've also been working on Youth Pass. The creation of that was in around 2008, and it was originally funded by the Business Energy Tax Credit, otherwise known as BETC. And in 2011, this legislature eliminated the BETC, which, while there may have been good reasons for doing so, essentially it's a situation in which we kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater. Since 2011, Youth Pass has been on the chopping block locally, and it's been a struggle to maintain the program that we currently have. And additionally, the program is not equitable within the city of Portland. Only Portland Public School students currently have access to the program, while other school districts within the city of Portland boundaries do not receive it. So one of the things that ourselves and partners have been looking at is how to replace the BETC in an equitable manner, which brought us to explore access to education from a statewide perspective. And in the 2015 legislative session, working in coalition, we brought forward a youth transit initiative, and currently it's in a work group stage. Programs like Youth Pass allow schools to capitalize on existing public transportation, take cars off the road, and reduce the level of air toxics near schools. It also nurtures the next generation of transit users by familiarizing students with public transportation. This can lead to long-term reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and more people feeling comfortable embracing low-emission alternatives. Inequitable land use and zoning are also root causes of many current disparities, and OPAL will continue to lead efforts to repeal the statewide prohibition on inclusionary zoning, as well as advance local incentive-based programs to ensure mixed-income housing developments, particularly along transit improvement corridors, such as Powell Division, in order to create opportunities for positive, healthy outcomes for people at all income levels. Lastly, OPAL environmental justice is by its nature interdisciplinary, involving many social change issues such as civil rights, workforce equity, and economic justice. I would encourage members of this committee to show leadership by approaching issues with an intersectional lens. OPAL's theory of change is based on grassroots organizing, capacity building, leadership development, community empowerment, and self-determination. A lot of our mainstream partners are currently entering into equity and inclusion work, but OPAL and other environmental justice organizations are founded on meaningful involvement on communities most impacted by policy decisions. It's a good thing when mainstream organizations become better allies and make strides to be more equitable and inclusive. However, environmental justice at its core is about community, about engaging with those who are most impacted to lead on creating the solutions. OPAL and other environmental justice organization advocates seek transformational change over transactional gains. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. My name is Stephanie Knoll. I'm deputy director with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and I'm going to cover three main points. An introduction to our mission and history as an organization, our commitment to equity, diversity, and inclusion, and one of our core campaigns to create safe routes to school for every kid. The bicycle transportation creates healthy, sustainable communities by making bicycling safe, convenient, and accessible. We were founded by predominantly white middle-class men, and to this day we continue to be a predominantly white middle-class organization in terms of our staff, our board, and our membership. But as we learn from community partners that have been committed to environmental justice from their inception, our work as a bicycle advocacy organization is evolving to include a new and more diverse group of Oregonians. Recently, our board of directors adopted a new racial equity policy outlining our commitment to becoming a more multicultural organization. It spans work on culturally inclusive hiring practices, equity training for all of our staff, and making sure that we're continuing to evaluate our policy work and programs through an equity lens. A big part of this work has been committing to meaningful partnerships with other organizations in the environmental justice community. Towards many of these goals, we now include community capacity building and pass-through grant support is a major piece of our big campaigns to increase partners' capacity to engage in this work. One such campaign has been our campaign for Safe Routes to School for Every Kid. Safe Routes to School is combined education, encouragement, and infrastructure approach to making streets safe for kids to walk and bike to school. It's often not talked about along with other transportation demand management efforts because of its focus on youth, but the robust evaluation of Safe Routes to School programs shows it to be some of the most successful transportation demand strategy that exists in changing behavior. And very quickly and also for the long term for youth and their families. Oregon needs to increase the investment to make it safe to walk, bike, and access transit to school. And we need to make sure that our focus is on schools with the greatest need, or Title I schools. Right now, 66%, two-thirds of youth in Oregon are not getting the daily recommended amount of physical activity that they need to be healthy. And when we overlay the maps in the Portland metro area of highest obesity rates and highest rates of diabetes with our map of Title I schools, or those schools where more than 50% of students qualify for free and reduced lunch, there's near perfect alignment. Also, work that has been done around built environment atlases as it relates to equity shows that areas with the least access to active transportation infrastructure have some of the highest environmental justice health concerns. Part of our work with environmental justice partners in evaluating what Safe Routes to School looks has expanded our definition for it to include transit access for youth. Vivian Satterfield here already referenced the legislative work group that has been assembled to address youth transit access, and we look forward to the results of that group in increasing investment in youth mobility. Currently, the state of Oregon only invests $500,000 in education and encouragement of Safe Routes to School per biennium. This is a small fraction of the amount of that was invested in Safe Routes to School under the last federal transportation bill. This popular statewide program would function much more effectively by tripling that funding, getting it back to historic levels, and including this new focus on transit access as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you, all of you, for coming today to talk about this and the different perspectives from your organizations. I think there's a commitment from the legislature that as we're talking about different policies, especially around climate and everything, of engaging on environmental justice issues and having voices at the table for that. So thank you all very much for coming today. All right, the next panel that we have up here, or the next topic we're going to cover, is the Community Solar Report with Jason. Jason Eisdorfer, welcome. It's good to see you again.
A panel of one.
We
like those.
Good afternoon, Chair Vager Peterson, members of the committee. I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Program Director at the Public Utility Commission. And you invited us here today to talk about the commission's response to the direction in House Bill 2941, which you passed earlier this year, that directed the commission to examine a range of community solar programs and or potential attributes of such programs so that customers could share in the cost and benefits of solar facilities. And as part of that proceeding, the commission was to look at certain aspects, such as cost to participants and to non-participants, the role of utilities, and any other reasonable considerations that the commission might think about. And ultimately, the commission was directed to recommend to the Legislative Assembly by November 1 of this year either a community solar program design or a set of preferred attributes. And on October 26th, the commission did forward that letter to you all. So I'm here to sort of run through some of those points. First quick little point is that it was a pretty quick turnaround from the passage of the bill to the recommendation from the commission. We still had a pretty robust stakeholder process where we had four rounds of comments, two work groups, and ultimately a hearing before the commission. But it was decided relatively early because of the compressed timeline that folks, stakeholders, agreed that trying to get an agreement around a particular community solar design was probably maybe a bridge too far, and that was, time was better spent on that list of attributes. So ultimately, the recommendation to the to this committee and to the legislature as a whole is in the form of these attributes. So the letter that was delivered in October really has three parts to it. The first part is the definition of community solar, which the bill itself did not contain. Second is a set of criteria which the commission used to judge the various attributes, and the third is the attributes themselves. Since the statute didn't define community solar, the parties and the stakeholders spent a little bit of time trying to do that to their satisfaction. Ultimately, they did. It's listed in the letter, and it talks about, it's a short definition, but it talks about basically community solar is allowing folks who don't have the ability to install solar capacity on their residences to participate anyway in sharing the costs and risks of a solar project. So that was basically an agreed upon definition from the stakeholders. The four criteria that the commission ultimately used to determine the attributes, I'm just going to run through those very quickly. The first is similar to what I just said, is that the program should stress providing fair access to Oregon households and small businesses that don't have the ability to install solar on their property. The programs should shift no costs onto non-participating ratepayers. The program should be designed for easy and efficient administration. And finally, that we allow for adaptation as we gain experience. So essentially, we do this in phases. So there are 13 recommended attributes that the commission offers up if you are interested in crafting additional legislation. And I'm not going to go through all of them, but I will highlight a few. The first one is that community solar should be available to residential and small commercial customers, and obviously leaving out under community solar the medium and large commercial and industrial customers. And it should be noted that currently the commission is working on a docket related to utilities, whether utilities should be able to offer large commercial and industrial customers access to a renewable energy tariff. In fact, I think there is a hearing in early December to start bringing that one to a close. So in terms of community solar, the commission suggests that this is really a small commercial and residential program, and the other docket is more appropriately considered the large customers. There's issues of direct access, competitive markets, and issues that aren't as relevant in the community solar space. Next one is that there should be an initial cap on the amount of load from each utility that can choose community solar. And this is that staging approach where there's an initial cap. We begin to run the program, see how it works, and if it's working, to give the commission the authority to adjust the cap after a couple of years. Next attribute is that there should be a bill credit equal to the resource value of solar. This is the value of solar that actually the commission is also working on the resource value of solar, which will probably not be finished until sometime in 2016. But it's to look at the various value streams of solar that perhaps the commission doesn't currently fully appreciate. And that's a pretty robust process that's going on right now. Next one is that investor-owned utilities should be permitted to own a community solar project, although this is subject to additional rules and elements that the commission might adopt in order to protect the public interest and to prevent cost shifting. Whenever you have the utility owning a resource in a more competitive kind of space, there's issues involved there. So the commission didn't go deeper into the idea of developing those additional elements, but we think that those may be necessary. The next one is that the commission should be directed to explore and implement ways to promote access to community solar by low-income Oregonians. That was an issue that we heard quite a bit about from the stakeholders. And then finally, even though the commission's recommendations only apply to the investor-owned utilities, the commission did say in its letter that if the state believes and the legislature believes that community solar is a good state policy for the investor-owned utilities, then a similar policy should be applied to the consumer-owned utilities as well. And so that, I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Jason. Questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just curious, the cap, I think it's obvious, why the cap?
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Benz, again, I think that there are some novel issues involved with a community solar. This is allowing a certain subset of ratepayers to essentially leave the existing resources of the utility and get hooked up to a particular solar facility. And so that that customer both pays the cost of that facility but also gets the benefits of that. Generally, that's not how regulation has worked for a century. It's usually we're all in it together kind of thing. And so beginning to peel this apart and having both costs and benefits go with a particular subset of customers, there are some novel issues in there. And so the idea of a cap is to work, I guess give the commission time to work through some of those issues. Once we feel like we're doing that and the stakeholders are happy with the program, then the commission could lift that cap.
Right, and there must have been some pretty interesting conversations in regard to the amount of the cap and alternatives to the cap and all of that. But this is there such a demand that you anticipate that the cap is going to be exceeded quickly, or is this something you're anticipating might happen and hasn't yet?
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Benz, I wish I could tell you that. It's equal to about 19 megawatts of capacity on the PGE side and about 13 megawatts of capacity on the PacifiCorp system. So it's not tiny, but neither is it huge. And so we're trying to find a space to we were told, I think, the stakeholders didn't want us to call this a pilot. It was a phase, because it's not like we're going to do this and then reject it, like what you might get through a pilot. But it does give us a sufficient amount of space to see exactly what kind of response there is from the community solar developer side, and then what kind of response that we have from the customer base side. I'm not sure we really know that at this point.
This is extremely interesting, because, of course, watching what's happened in Germany and other places that weren't as careful, it was really bad news for established utilities. So there must be a number for the so-called, this is all the wrong language, but stranded cost that everybody else would be stuck with if people skate out the door with cheaper solar than what they might have to otherwise pay for. So are those numbers being crunched so that if somebody wanted to bring a really big project in, they would be saddled with an appropriate portion of those long-term investments to stretch out into the future?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Vance, by comparison, stranded costs is an issue that we are not just aware of, but concerned about. There are a number of new technologies that will, I think, continue to enable folks to begin to think about leaving the system, and what costs are left with remaining customers is a matter of concern. So by comparison, the industrial-sized direct access program is capped at 300 average megawatts. This is apples and oranges. This is 19 megawatts. So we're doing this in relatively small pieces. Once we get our sort of feet on the ground and figure out that we know what we're doing, we can then sort of figure out if there's another tranche that is appropriate to go forward. But clearly, customers, the increasing amount of choice that customers have is an issue that is a challenge. It's both an opportunity and a challenge. And so I think the best way to just say that is that we are trying to learn through this process as well. And I think that what the commission was really looking forward to was having an opportunity to do this in stages and steps.
With your indulgence,
This
is super interesting because we don't tell customers that they have bought into a 20-year package by virtue of having that ability to flip the lights on right now today. We don't tell them that. They have bought into it, and the PUC has helped, facilitated, protected utilities so that we would all enjoy that arrangement. And now if someone came in with an incredible breakthrough, and we're still stuck with that 20-year investment we haven't paid off yet. So are you trying to advise your customers that indeed they're liable for that, and this is how they're paying it? This is how this shows up? I mean, there should be a little thing on the bottom of the bill saying, oh, by the way, you need to stay our customer for 20 years to help pay off all the stuff we did for you so you could have lights today. Are we doing that?
Commissioner... Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz, no. It's sort of baked into the entire the regulatory compact. We regulate the utilities because they are monopolies. For most of the better part of a century, customers really haven't had many choices. They haven't had any choices, really, to leave. And so the whole theory of investing in a gas plant or a coal plant, some of these are half a billion, in some cases billion or $2 billion investments. And so the regulatory compact literally 100 or more years has been, we're sort of all in this together to help build and in one sense almost overbuild the system. And so that's... I don't think it's the commission's role necessarily to protect the utility from changing times, but there is also the danger if customers have choices. If some customers have choices, it's a little bit like the panel you just had. If some customers have more choices and some customers have less choices, the customers with less choices end up holding a larger part of the cost. And so that, as these new concepts, as these new technologies come forward, it's a matter of, on the one hand, not getting in the way of them, but on the other hand, making sure that there's a fair and equitable solution to all of this. So, for example, very quickly, in the direct access provision for the large industrial customers, there is a transition charge. It says if you're going to leave the system, you're going to essentially pay some of the above market costs that might otherwise be left behind with other customers. And those, even if they're leaving the utility, they're taking some costs with them. So it is one of the things that causes me to enjoy my job, but also to lose sleep at night.
Thank you.
Representative Colby.
Yeah, thank you. Just following up on that discussion of the cap, because I sort of stumbled around the concept of that cap, and you know, regardless of whether it's a half a percent or a 1% or whatever you come up with, I mean, I can see the trying to understand why the cap, but on the flip side, why isn't there a target as well.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holby, that is a fair question. And it's ultimately maybe the answer is I'm not sure how we figure out what the target is necessarily, and maybe that's the recommendation is to do this in stages, is to figure out what the market can provide and what the demand of the customers is. And so, for example, if we blow through this half a percent of capacity in a moment's notice, then we know that maybe there's more demand for it. If it takes a while to get there, then maybe we do it in a slower set of stair steps. So I'm not sure that I can tell you right now. If you were to ask, what is the what should be the target? I'm not sure I know at this point. I think it's fair to let this out, get the rules right, get the structure right. Right, both for the developer, the utility, and the customer, and the regulator, frankly, because there's elements in there that increase the amount of time that my staff will spend on it. So get all of that right, see what the reaction to the demand is, and then from there, I think it's sort of a self-fulfilling target in a sense, or at least you have a better sense of what a target should be.
I have another unrelated question, but okay. Still on the same topic. I also was, I just found it interesting when you talked about system ownership, the statement was that investor-owned utilities should be permitted to own and operate a community solar project. I'm assuming that the commission is not trying to preclude third-party ownership and developers from these projects, because they're not mentioned in that statement, only investor-owned utilities, like a third-party nonprofit or just, a third-party developer.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holby, absolutely not. The assumption actually was that the third-party owner was the predominant owner. The debate amongst the stakeholders was whether the utility should get to play there as well. And there are some interesting issues there. I mean, if on the one hand, if the utility gets to play, it's sort of another option. Some people may consider that a safer option, some customers. On the other hand, and this goes to the elements related to the conditions to protect the public interest and prevent cost shifting. If the utilities do play, do they actually crowd out that third-party developer space? And so I think there, again, that's one of the things that I think the legislature could kick to the commission, have some more discussion with the stakeholders and shareholders, and then sort of try to find out what that right balance is in terms of conditions that might let the utilities own, but also make sure that there's enough space for third parties to come in and develop.
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair, I just wanted to ensure that the Commission wasn't intending to eliminate third party ownership
and
those recommendations.
Not.
One of the other things that I've just been trying to figure out in my mind is the low income customer participation in this. And I guess the idea is, everybody should be able to have solar, but I would imagine that solar is a more expensive power source. And if the idea is that the owners of the solar or the subscribers, I think those words might be interchangeable, are subsidizing the rate that the low-income people would have to pay for that solar power. I think that's how it works out. I'm just kind of was trying to review that in my mind. Does it make more sense for there to be a percentage of each of the ratepayers' rate to help low-income people pay their utility bills, for example? Would that be a more useful I'm just trying to understand how a low-income person is going to really benefit from being subsidized in participating in a solar project as opposed to getting some help paying their bills.
Chair Baker Peterson, Representative Holby, those are all excellent questions. Those are topics that folks mulled over for a while. There is currently a portion of everybody's bill on the residential side that helps to pay for bill payment assistance. This was a little different. This was trying to make sure that community solar isn't just for a certain class of folks, that it could be a little bit more broadly applied. And there's a little bit of a conflict between one of the commissions and some parties' bottom line, which is that you don't shift costs. And so what you said a minute ago is exactly what a number of folks had brought forward, which is that the participants could actually choose. I mean, one could imagine two or three options to go to. Developers have created a couple of options, and one developer in particular says, I want my community solar to be spread broadly regardless and give everyone, even low-income folks, an opportunity to get it. That would generally mean that the participants paying into that option are paying that little bit more to create a subsidy for lower-income folks. So it stays within that community solar project, and therefore it doesn't sort of bounce outside and start raising rates for other folks.
But I
will say, I guess, that while that was explored, that wasn't, I don't think there was a final, stakeholders, I think, had a lively conversation around that, but didn't really reach a conclusion on what exactly that design looks like.
Yeah, I'm not saying I'm opposed to it. I was just trying to think, you know, if that's the right mechanism to deliver a benefit to the low-income community. It may, in fact, be. Could you speak a little bit, just generally follow up? Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, thank you. Could you speak just a little bit about the ownership of the RECs? I struggle with that piece as well, a little bit, trying to understand the importance of who owns the REC.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holby, another big important question. If RECs that came out of community solar were used to then comply with the RPS, with the Renewable Portfolio Standard, that would mean that a subset of voluntary customers were essentially potentially paying a little bit more to buy RECs that benefits everybody. And so, and it would be harder at that point to say, well, that they are buying into that solar resource and getting the full benefit of it. So the commission heard some comments on this, and I think appropriately came to the conclusion that RECs generated from this community solar are retired on behalf of those participants. They're paying for it. It's their benefit, and it's not a benefit that can be used to meet state RPS law on everyone else's behalf. Does that help?
So you're saying you're trying to prevent the REC from being used twice?
In a sense, and clearly trying to make sure that the value of the REC stays with those who pay for it.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. Thank you, Madam Speaker, for your indulgence.
I'm a speaker?
Or,
that's fine.
Madam
Chair.
We'll go with that. Might as well take a raise.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Holby asked some of the same questions that I had, too. But first of all, thanks, Jason, for your good work. I know that has been a quick turnaround since the passage of the bill and so forth. But I wanted to just delve into that, you know, cost shifting a bit more, because I'm just looking at the recommendations, and it came from the commission, and number two being the program should shift no cost to non-participating ratepayers. So how can you really do that? Because we know the cost of that power has got to be more expensive than the base load for that the customers are generally paying. So unless there's a way to, you know, again, some sort of way to mask that. And again, I guess what we're trying to, I guess, prevent to a certain extent is what we see happening with you know, net metering to it, you know, where there is no, unquestionably, you know, cost shift that happens there. To what extent can we,
ensure that we're not putting an additional burden on those low income, lower level ratepayers who just don't have additional means to pay for that increased cost.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, we can do that. What we'll do is we'll know what the cost of the output of that resource is on a per unit basis. That cost will then be passed on to the participant. There's some other. I think it gets a little more difficult if the utility itself is the owner of the resource, and we have to dive a little bit deeper into some of that. But I think for the most part, we figure out what the cost of that resource is going to be on a per unit basis, and those customers are going to be paying that cost, and for that ought to take care of most of the cost shift. There could be some additional administrative costs that could be borne to run the program, and those costs, once the program is up and running, those costs also should be should stay with the participants and not the ratepayer as a whole.
Okay. Hello. So I noticed down in the heading entitled subscription size that you do have some specific criteria in there that an eligible customer should be allowed to subscribe up to the customer's average annual load. So is that intentionally to kind of, again, eliminate that situation we have in net metering where some people can actually get a return greater than, their typical obligation on a monthly basis would be? This kind of gets to what Representative Holvey, I think, was asking, in that it says that those over and above would be redistributed perhaps in a way that could benefit those lower income ratepayers. Is that correct?
Chair Baker Peterson, Representative Johnson. Yes, it's. I guess the other way of saying that, though, is that we, in thinking this through, tried to create some equal par between being able to put a resource on your house and doing it through community solar. And as you know, the net metering says if you. The theory behind only being able to use what you generate can only sort of cover what your load is to make sure that people right size the facility on their roof, and that anything on an annual basis, anything over and above that actually gets to deliver the value of it to low income folks. And so it was trying to mimic that. It was trying to say it should. You should right-size your subscription that you buy into approximately what your load actually is.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
I wanted to get into also another question related to this, but Rep. Helm and I had the benefit of attending a conference in D.C. We're both recent graduates of the Legislative Energy Horizons Institute. Bring your diploma with you, by the way.
We're vandals now.
Yeah, we're vandals, right? We got T-shirts and everything. One of the criticisms we heard about residential PV is, as opposed to compare and contrasting with utility scale, is the fixed nature of the panels aren't optimally installed to take advantage. They don't track as utility scale can in some ways. The tracking systems for the panel themselves mean that the actual installations are less effective than a utility scale. My question related to community-based, have you considered criteria in there for the design of these systems to where they would employ some of the same more efficiency-focused design characteristics that you can see in utility scale to make sure that if, in fact, we're going to be serious about this and providing this renewable energy-producing opportunity to everybody, that those installations as they're installed are as effective as possible, producing the greatest value for the ratepayers and for the system in general? Has that conversation come up in this discussion you've had?
Chair Baker-Peterson, Representative Johnson, I don't recall anyone clamoring for sort of more regulatory oversight over the development itself. I think the theory would be if this does take off, there's going to be a number of different kinds of resources, number of different kind of developments, and Those that are more efficient will have will cost less to sign up for. Exactly. You know, so if the theory is true, it'll show up in the price.
Right. Well, it's more than theory.
Yeah, well.
But anyway, and one final follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
In the bill, Section 2 also talks about how the PUC will give us back some feedback on other types of residential and other solar programs that the state currently has on the books and give us recommendations on which are the most effective and efficient and so forth. Is that also coming? Or in progress? I don't see that in this recommendation, just primarily about community solar.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, that is a different deadline, thank goodness.
Come on.
That is, I think, September of next year.
Yeah, okay.
And that is a full menu review of all, including this one, of all the various solar policies, and so you'll be getting that one soon enough.
Good. Thank you very much. Appreciate your work.
The time will just fly by the time we get there.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an exciting development. I'm looking forward to seeing the results. On this issue of resource value of solar, that is a different question. I think that we're going in the right direction to look at that, because there are different values that go into that final calculation that aren't all monetary. My concern is we're running this pilot, which is maybe going to start pretty soon, and we have a different standard officially in place for valuing the energy that's coming out to understand whether we're getting the rate of return we want and protecting consumers. But then the standard might change before the end of the project. How are we going to handle that situation so that we really understand the success or failure of community solar pilot?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Helm, so that not only is that a good point, that is something that we've been thinking about. Let me actually go to... So the attribute that the commission identified on that one was that the bill credit should equal the resource value of solar unless the PUC finds good cause to deviate from that rate. And so I think one good cause from deviating from that rate is because we don't have it yet, but you want to get the program moving. And so if the resource value of solar, I will tell you that that is a difficult docket. It's extremely important because rates will actually be developed around it. So I think the commission wants to do a good job on that. We're actually getting some outside consulting help on that. And there are, you know, anywhere between a half a dozen and a dozen potential value streams that we don't do a good job of quantifying now that may suddenly come into play with regard to the resource value of solar. So that may be as much as a year away from now. And, you know, it may be that with the legislature working on additional legislation, it may be the timing is just right. And so just as we get projects on the ground, we'll be able to use the established resource value of solar. If there are projects that are ready to go before that, I think we would take a crack at trying to figure out what an appropriate rate would be. We'd have to grandfather those folks in, because you're right, it would change. You don't want to change. If someone's signing up for a 5 or 10 year product, you can't change the rate a year or two into it. That's just sort of not fair. And so we would sort of grandfather that first phase of rate in. But yes, I mean, we've thought that through. It's the timing isn't perfect, although it could be that it could be just as a community solar project is actually ready to go, we might have the resource value of solar, and it could work very well.
One follow-up. And I would think, although I'm not very good at math, you might be able to reverse calculate with your experience of starting the program with the new standard, since you'll have a quantity there, and see what it would have been if you had started with that from the beginning.
Right. We can do that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative
Vince. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the public purpose charge, do they get to pay it?
They would.
The community folks pay the public purpose charge.
Yes, can't get out of that.
How is it calculated?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Bence, it would, by statute, it's 3% of their retail revenue, so it would be whatever they're paying and what they're paying, the 3% of that. So what, I honestly don't know at this point what the, I can't tell you that this is going to be more expensive or less expensive or what the resource value of solar is going to do and how that's going to net out. So, I mean, they can't, folks won't be escaping the energy efficiency part of the public purposes and all those other pieces. I'm just not sure I know what the calculation is yet.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jason, for the update on this report. I think we're going to be hearing more about this in the February session. One of the things that was I noted was the scope of this. The recommendation was just that it should be available to all electric customers statewide, even though the direction of the report was solely under the PUC's purview of the investor. So I think that'll be an interesting part of the conversation. And then the other piece was we've had several questions about low income ratepayers and low-income customers and how that would factor into the program that was put together. I know that in states like Colorado, they have a carve-out that's part of the legislation, of having at least 10% for low-income set aside for low-income customers. It looked like here it was the PUC was asking to be directed in rule to set that up, or is that the correct reading of it? Or
Chair Baker Peterson, I think the commission would always prefers the legislature in something like this to tell them exactly what you want to do. I mean, from a statutory authority point of view, it's much cleaner if the statute says you have to do this particular thing, with especially if you're talking about rate differentials. Generally, the existing statutory authority for the commission is to make sure that people who are situated in like situations pay the same rate, and so if there's a subsidy involved or a different rate involved, that's something that I think the legislature needs to speak to.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, Jason.
Thank you.
For this. All right. With that, we are going to have now hear from about the 7th Northwest Conservation and Electric Power Plan, and we have Ben. Oh, and I'm not going to get your last name right. Kujala. Is that close, Ben?
Yeah,
welcome.
Thank you, Chair Pega Peterson and representatives. My name is Ben Quiela. I work with the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, and no one says the last name right, so absolutely no problem there. So I'd just like to say I would like to discuss our recent draft plan, but first, just to give you guys some context, I'd like to go over the history of the Northwest Power and Conservation Council and a little bit about the Power Act, which is the thing that spawned it. I'm assuming... There we go. So, in 1938, Congress formed the Bonneville Power Administration to market power from the federal hydroelectric projects and to build transmission to make sure that that power could be delivered. Almost 30 years later, in 1965, BPA raised its power rate for the first time. In real terms, from 1938 until the 70s, the power rate fell, and it was cheaper to buy power later on. Most of the region's electricity needs were met by expanding the hydroelectric system. That was true through the 70s, and a large part of that power was managed by Bonneville. In the early 70s, the potential and the appetite for the hydroelectric system, it was dwindling, and regional utility planners started looking at more expensive ways to generate electricity. Bonneville began the process now known as the Hydrothermal Power Plan. Under that, Bonneville was restricted by law from owning additional power plants, but under a net billing arrangement, customers of Bonneville would build power plants, and Bonneville would credit their bills for the expenses, and in return, Bonneville would market the output. So under the arrangement, Bonneville effectively owned the output of the power plants, and they did bear the costs, but they were not directly responsible for managing those power plants. The Washington Public Power Supply System, or WPS, started planning and construction of three nuclear power plants funded with net billing under this arrangement. Two more plants were funded directly by the utilities and eventually resulted in one of the largest municipal bond defaults in history. A long chain of construction delays and cost increases to Bonneville resulted in them increasing their rates over 400% from 1978 to 1984. Two of the three nuclear plants funded under net billing never generated a single watt. The debt incurred building those plants is still being paid for by all of the consumers in the Northwest right now. Over the years since essentially the failure of the hydrothermal plant, it's likely the average consumer in the Northwest has paid thousands of dollars for power that just never generated anything, power plants that were canceled. In retrospect, a lack of transparency, poor planning practices inside and outside of Bonneville resulted in a very unfortunate and expensive outcome. The states, including Oregon, had no direct influence over the risks that Bonneville was taking on behalf of their citizens. So in 1980, when the consequences of the hydrothermal power plan were becoming apparent, the United States Congress passed the Northwest Power Act. The act directed the states of Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington to form the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. The council is funded by money collected by Bonneville from firm power sales. It consists of 8 members, 2 members from each of the states. And it's each of those members is appointed by the state governors. The council was directed to create a power plan that assured the Northwest would have adequate, efficient, economic, and reliable power. It also to create a fish and wildlife program to protect, mitigate, and enhance fish and wildlife, and to ensure widespread public involvement in the formulation of regional power policies. Congress delegated the authority to the council to review any acquisition of a major resource or a resource that generated over 50 average megawatts for 5 years by Bonneville. If the council finds the acquisition of the resource inconsistent with the power plan by a majority vote, then the BPA administrator must thereafter determine that notwithstanding such inconsistency, the resource is needed to meet BPA's obligation, and BPA must obtain specific authorization to expend funds for that resource by an act of Congress. So basically that says that without either the council saying that a resource is consistent with the power plan or Congress giving Bonneville direct authority, they can't buy a major resource again, such as a nuclear power plant, whether it's through net building or otherwise. So in 1983, the first power plan was published. It directed the region to rely predominantly on energy efficiency to meet the region's growing need for electricity. The subsequent plans, the second through the sixth power plan, which were released basically each five-year period, they all directed the region to rely predominantly on energy efficiency as the major resource. The draft of the seventh plan continues this legacy. It also relies predominantly on energy efficiency. By the mid-90s, the market price for electricity was extremely low. Deregulation led to utilities, both public and private, depend on a market to serve their customers rather than looking to Bonneville. Under that environment, Bonneville was reluctant to spend a bunch of money acquiring energy efficiency because people were looking elsewhere for their resource. Mm-hmm. So Bonneville can significantly cut its spending on energy efficiency in the mid to late 90s. The third power plan said, of all the options the region, the third power plan, I should say, is in the early to mid-90s. Of all the options the region faced, inaction would expose the people and the economy to the greatest risk. The fourth power plan said, in even extreme scenarios, the development of further cost-effective conservation is a positive long-term investment for the region. In the shorter term, however, conservation requires the region incur some higher cost today compared to buying electricity off the West Coast market. For conservation to be successfully developed in the future, the near-term cost must be weighed against the longer-term benefits. In 1999, the Resource Adequacy Forum, a forum of the council along with regional stakeholders, issued a warning that there was over a 30% likelihood the regional firm electricity supply would be insufficient. In 2001, extremely low water runoff of the Columbia Basin translated into less regional generation from hydropower. That, in addition to market manipulation, resulted in the Western U.S. energy crisis or the California energy crisis. Litigation over prices paid for power during the crisis carried on for over a decade. Large industrial customers of electricity were bought out of their contracts, and hundreds of jobs in this region were permanently lost when those industries did not all reopen. In part because of the experience during the Western U.S. energy crisis, where there was a shortage of resources, the region has met or exceeded goals set forth on energy efficiency in the Council's power plan since 2001. It showed the importance of Bonneville and the other regional utilities acting consistent with the power plans to acquire sufficient energy efficiency to avoid a regional firm resource shortfall. Today, consumers of electricity are still paying for costs incurred during both the hydrothermal power plant and the Western U.S. energy crisis. In the power system, the mistakes of the past carry into the future in the form of increased costs. And the cost of electricity, as you all know, impacts the sector, many other sectors of the regional economy. Fortunately, the region started with a very low-cost hydroelectric generation system. Thus, in spite of previous mistakes, the region still enjoys some of the lowest electric rates in the country. So, the council produces a regional power plan to provide guidance to regional utilities. Bonneville Power Administration is required by the Power Act to act in a manner consistent with the power plan. One of the goals of the plan is to avoid having the region put in a situation to risk another large avoidable expense that will ultimately fall on the residents and the businesses of the region. One of the best tools to mitigate the risk has been energy efficiency. Since the first power plant in 1983, the region has achieved over 5,800 average megawatts of energy efficiency. That's about enough energy to power five cities the size of Seattle. The draft plan recommends that by 2021, we reach over 7,200 average megawatts of energy efficiency. This will result in tens of thousands of dollars that consumers would have otherwise spent on electric bills being available to circulate back into the regional economy. So here you can see in the seventh plan, we are relying in the green wedge here is energy efficiency. And on average, energy efficiency meets most of the need through the 20-year planning period. And 20 years was set out through the Power Act as a requirement. Towards the end, you see some additional solar and wind that's based on RPS requirements. So it's actually put into our model what the current RPS requirements are, and then a little bit of natural gas towards the end. They're filling in for additional resource. This is in terms of average energy, so it kind of gets you the picture of all the fuel picture, so to speak. If you put it in terms of capacity, it's even the same kind of stark picture, where energy efficiency, when you have an instantaneous need, is serving more of that need than any other resource. And demand response adds a little bit on top of that. Renewables in our draft plan didn't add a lot towards that winter capacity peak. Solar does not generate as much during winter capacity, and wind is also something that it doesn't, it's there, but it doesn't really show visibly on this graph. The thermal system also then would fill in for the remaining capacity towards the end of our study. If you look over the 20-year time horizon of the plan, you'll see that overall, after energy efficiency and federal codes and standards, we expect a net decline in the regional loads. And that is essentially looking at the most cost-effective strategy for this region. So, as I've already said, the Draft 7 plan continues to emphasize energy efficiency as the predominant resource for the region. Beyond that, the draft power plan examines several different scenarios reducing the regional carbon dioxide emissions. The Environmental Protection Agency recently released a final rule for the Clean Power Plan. The draft plan finds that on a regional level, current policy would comply with the emission limits put forth in the Clean Power Plan. However, individual states may have issues depending on their approach to compliance with the Clean Power Plan. So what we see is natural gas generation is the primary thing that adapts to the CO2 reduction policies. So if we had no coal retirements in this region, right now there are three plants that are scheduled that serve this region to retire: Boardman, Centralia, and North Valmy. North Valmy is not located in this region, but serves load inside this region. If they didn't retire, then you would see that the gas dispatch would actually go down. We would see our existing gas system used a little bit less. Coal would continue to be there. The energy efficiency would be eating away, essentially, at what the natural gas dispatch would be. Because of those retirements, right now you see that as each one retires, you see a bump in the natural gas generation to make up for the difference. So gas generation is relatively flat under kind of a business as usual, just with those retirements case. So if we want to do the maximum that's possible to reduce CO2, and in this case we looked at retiring any coal generation and inefficient natural gas generation, and then relying on the existing efficient gas generation, adding in gas generation, energy efficiency, and demand response, we would actually start to use the natural gas system more to help fill in for extra retirements of generations that produce more emissions. And then under a 35% RPS, where you would take 35% of the regional demand for electricity and actually look at all the different states, so Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana would all take 35% of load, whether it's public or private. It was just kind of a boundary condition. Under that situation, where you add a bunch of renewables into the system, we actually do see the natural gas system dispatch down.
Question, Representative Johnson.
Just a quick question. How are you defining demand response? It's different than natural gas. What are you referring to?
Sure. Demand response is essentially going to a customer of a utility and making a contract with them to say that during a time where the system is at stress, so if it's the utility is in a situation where they're going to have to take some really expensive emergency actions to keep the grid stable, rather than them doing those expensive things, they can actually just pay a customer to shift their load down or something like that.
I get it. So it's within the grid.
Yeah, within the grid. So it usually large industrial or customers, commercial customers, are kind of your low-hanging fruit in that. They have big loads, so the more they can move them around, the better.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So one of the main things we did find in this is that the EPA carbon dioxide emission regulations can be met on a regional basis. We didn't look at each state's things, and frankly, the final rule has just been out for a little while, and there's a lot of decisions that need to be made following that. But from that, we see under no coal retirement and each of these policies, it has a very different implication for the amount of emissions. Overall, you can see that that orange line there, the last line, is the limits from the EPA in terms of the emissions. So almost every policy that we looked at met the on a regional level met the EPA 111D limits. Now, in the very last year of that graph, you can see that each of these scenarios had a very different amount of emissions coming out of it. To give you a general sense, our average CO2 emissions in this region from 2000 to 2012 is around 55 million metric tons. Under the situation where we weren't seeing any coal retirements, we came in around an average of 45. Right now, with the announced retirements, we think the region's going to get down to around 34 on average. There's a lot of variability because of water conditions, but on average, we expect it to be around 34. The renewable portfolio standard, increasing that to 35% for 100% of the regional demand for electricity, reduced it a further 5. Using the social cost of carbon that's put out by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change gets you down in that 20 range. Unless you use the high one, that gets you down to the 18. And by doing the maximum that we can do with existing technology, which is to retire all inefficient natural gas and coal generation and replace it with highly efficient natural gas-fired thermal generation, you can get down to about 12 million metric tons. So The incremental system cost, of course, of these policies is what you end up paying for that reduction. Under the renewable portfolio standard at 35%, the comparison to existing policy, it costs about $34 billion incrementally to the system to pursue that policy. That was over a cost that basically was not born if you did not put in that policy. So the existing policy kind of says without a carbon cost accounted for or anything like that, but you just do a 35% RPS, you spend a lot of money building renewable generation.
And that's over the entire Northwest region?
That's for the all four states, yes. The cost of retiring inefficient generation and putting in more efficient generation between the existing policy to reduce gets you down 80% or so in carbon emissions. That cost was around $20 billion. So overall, the strategy that we are putting forward in our draft plan says that we want to continue the regional legacy of aggressively acquiring energy efficiency. It's done very well for this region so far, and we anticipate that that will continue. We want to expand the use of demand response in the region to mitigate potential capacity shortfalls, needing energy at that really, really cold winter day when everyone's turning on the heater. And basically, we're directing to research solutions for renewable energy that can supply dependable capacity for winter peak electricity needs. So we want to see research pushed in that direction for renewable energies. And of course, last is to improve the use of existing resources to avoid the expense of building new resources unnecessarily. There's lots of efforts going on in that realm right now with energy imbalance markets and things along those lines. But it's definitely a recommendation for the plan. Key findings that we have is energy efficiency and demand response meet nearly all energy and capacity needs throughout the planning period, certainly in the beginning of it. The regional power system CO2 emissions can basically be reduced by around 80% with existing technology. And the increased RPS produces the smallest CO2 emission reductions and it's the highest cost emission reduction resource strategy. With that, Madam Chair and representatives, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about the draft power plan.
Questions?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the third bullet point, the RPS produces the smallest CO2 emissions reductions and is the highest cost. What's next to it? What are the alternatives?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz. The alternative that seems to produce the most reduction is to change the dispatch order, to use natural gas more heavily and try to use coal less. And measures that do that seem to be the most effective. Renewable portfolio standards without changing the order that you would dispatch those on based on economics tend to eat into the natural gas, which isn't really your highest emission, instead of really displacing coal generation, which is what tends to generate more of the emissions.
And you probably told us this, and I wasn't paying close enough attention, but this plan is for all energy generated in the Northwest, then, as opposed to just hydro?
Yes. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz, the Northwest, the power plan is essentially a regional look at what strategy for building out generation would benefit the region as a whole the most. So it doesn't make a distinction between public utilities or investor-owned utilities. It's looking at kind of a social benefit picture for the entire region.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find this slide timely but kind of ironic as well, in that, as we speak, there's a presentation going on that's talking about doubling the RPS from what we have been on track to meet, and I think meet pretty responsibly, but those saying that we need to double that. And your point would be that that's the most costly way for not just Oregon, but for the region to try to reduce carbon.
Yeah, Chair Vega Peterson, Representative John Johnson, yes. If your RPS policy is aimed at reducing carbon emissions, and that is the primary reason that you're putting it in place. It does seem like a very expensive way to accomplish that, and I think that's what we're trying to put forward in this draft.
And I guess what follow up what you're, it's based on the cost of renewables, certainly, to develop them. But I think what you're saying, though, is that I think we can apply today's technology and perhaps additional technologies to try to make it the current base load, i.e. natural gas and others that we're using, to use them in a way that emits fewer emissions, i.e. modernization of gas plants and so forth and so on. And that doesn't even begin to get into some of the carbon capture perhaps and sequestration technology that also is showing great promise as well.
Yes, Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson. It's using existing technology is one part of it, but also just using our existing system in a different way. So using more of the existing natural gas ahead of using the coal system makes a pretty large difference in and of itself. And that's what got you down to the 20 million metric tons. So really, incrementally between the 20 and the 12, it's those 8 million metric tons that you get from a lot of capital investment. And I would say in both of these strategies, what makes something expensive is when you have to start building something. Mm-hmm. So there's, as you saw, we had declining loads after energy efficiency. And under that circumstance, we do certainly have some retirements on the board, but it's very possible to stretch our existing system to meet a lot of our needs. And any policy where you end up building a lot of new power plants, whether they're renewable or otherwise, gets expensive very quickly.
Mm-hmm. One final question.
Yeah, follow up.
And then as your slide that talked about meeting future demands, and by far the majority of that was based on demand response and conservation. And I'm guessing, you know, Oregon, of course, we've done a tremendous amount on residential conservation, and i.e. through the public purpose yard and so forth, but are you quantifying where those conservations will occur? And I'm guessing it's more on the industrial and large capacity locations and stuff. It seems like we've wrung about as much out of the residential side as we can efficiently do here. Maybe you have a different viewpoint.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson. I don't know exactly the breakdown of the energy efficiency, but it is cross-sector for us. So we look at every single one, commercial, industrial, and residential. I know one of the big stories is, of course, lighting and the changes in technology that are going on there. So that's probably a big chunk of it. But there's really measures going for the whole span.
Great. Thank you very much.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm kind of wondering how the plan delivers on a couple of things that are mentioned in your plan, where the you're talking about investments and to improve operational agreements and to access site-based renewable energy and better integrate low and zero emission resources. And the plan states that it encourages investment in these resources when cost-effective. And then it turn around in the next sentence, is the plan encourages research and advanced technologies to improve efficiency and those sorts of things. So I'm kind of wondering, how does the plan actually achieve the encouragement of both of those simultaneously? Do you have a set percentage that we should be putting, or utilities should be putting into research of technologies, new technologies, or storage, or smart grid, or those sorts of things? Is there a fixed number that the plan recommends to accomplish that encouragement that you recognize in here? It just seems like it's sort of in conflict with your previous statement of encouraging investment in similar resources when they're cost effective, which makes me wonder, what's your definition of cost effective, and does, you know, the value of having more reliability in the grid because of a diverse resource source for energy throughout the geography of your Northwest Power Plant come into play in figuring out what's cost effective? It was a convoluted question, but maybe you can figure out what it was.
Chair Van Peterson, Representative Holby, we do definitely have some directives in terms of research, and it's trying to encourage what we saw were gaps in kind of the existing technology. So we are supposed to make recommendations in terms of the research that can be done in the region. We don't quantify the amount of money that you should be spending on that, but the main items in our plan, we have kind of an action plan that's directed at Bonneville specifically, but also the regional utilities and the utility commissions. And one of the main things that we saw was that there's a lot of renewable energy out there, but it doesn't necessarily serve the need at the moment that it's needed. And during winter peak times, we have seen that there's some ability to use the hydro system and other systems to kind of shift energy around. The underlying system can adapt to some amount, but it might be that you don't have a solar generation going exactly at your highest load time, which might be at night during the winter. Wind generation during a very cold time might also be low. So our recommendation for research was more based on kind of our understanding of the gaps in the existing system than necessarily looking at exactly how much money you should spend to get some result from that research. If that answers the question, I hope.
Well, thank you, follow-up. So, you know, how does the Northwest Power Plan encourage the BPA to make these investments in smart grid and, you know, some resiliency issues and, you know, on and on and on, you know, when it seems like you're also giving them a directive to do things when they're cost effective?
Chair Peterson, Representative Holvey, I think that the plan is not prescriptive on that, and that's probably intentional. BPA has a program that they've run that certainly we've consulted with them on their technology innovation and the investments that they're making in those technologies, but at this point, the council members have not determined that it's necessary to try to set a budget amount or something like that.
Sort of a follow-up, if I may, on Representative Holvey's question, but in terms of this research, I personally don't understand that the utilities typically do the research. They tend to purchase things more or less off the shelf or have equipment designed and built and that sort of thing. But so where would this, am I missing something here? Where would this research take place and who would fund it? And
Chair Peterson, Representative Reardon. That unfortunately wasn't specified in the Power Act when it was passed. We were supposed to give recommendations for research, but it wasn't necessarily directed as to who would pay for it or how it would get done. I can say that we work very closely with all the national labs, for example, constantly are interacting with them. We certainly work with the utilities to the extent that they're doing it. Bonneville has directly funded some research under their technology innovation program. So there are forums for that, and certainly we're having conversations with them, but I don't think there's a specific directive as to the private utilities to pay money for research under something through the Power Act.
Okay, that's kind of what I was hoping you'd say. Thank you.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there's a, I think we're all kind of wondering where the sense of urgency is and how it actually plays out. Is there a measure of the value of a ton of CO2 avoided today as opposed to 10 years from now?
Chair Meg Peterson, Representative Benz. I think I've definitely talked to people and heard research in terms of CO2 or CO2 equivalent gases and how that does impact the environment. Rather than trying to make a separate study of that, what we did was we used the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and their costs as they put into the social cost of carbon, and we used the mid and the high range to try to reflect the potential damage, and that price increases through time. And there's a exhaustive paper, which I've read through a couple of times, but can't say I'm an expert on, in terms of how you set up a discount rate and all that stuff. So it translates it back into dollars, but I believe it does have a kind of impact of a escalating carbon emissions and how that changes essentially the damage cost.
Follow up. Well, can you tell us from reviewing, and I've read a whole bunch of those papers too, and I don't understand any of them, so that's why I'm asking you, is there a a hair on fire measure here. Should we be really, really, really worried and do this today, or can we lollygag about, like under the LCFS, we don't have to worry about anything there for 5 years? Okay, so we got a 5-year wait before the price changes under the LCFS. What's the cost of that wait? And that's what I'm asking on what you just presented us here. Because we see, I looked at this chart here and I see it spread out over this many years, and I'm going, okay, should we do this tomorrow? And if so, why? No, I know the next panel is going to come up and share the answer. So you're off the hook. Maybe they won't.
Chair Peterson, Representative Benz, I certainly hope that they have more answers than I do for that, because I don't think I really do have an answer per se. I mean, I think what we've encouraged is a kind of common benefit from energy efficiency, which comes into not expending money in the power system, reducing CO2 emissions, all the various benefits that come out of that. They stack up, and it seems like a very obvious choice and a very beneficial one to the region. But in terms of if we were to take some sort of policy action today, we did run scenarios where we put a price on CO2 immediately, and it greatly reduced the amount of emissions over the course of that 20-year study. And that's something quantifiable that we could say, that this is a number of reduction that you get. And the more immediate the action, the larger the reduction. So it certainly stacks up over time. But that being said, it's hard to quantify in a broader sense of the entire damage cost and things like that, what that exactly means. So I hope your next panel has much better answers for you than I did.
Thank you. It's a big number.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for this presentation. This is very interesting, especially I think the background of why this report came to be and why these the power plan was necessary. The entire draft plan is actually on OLIS. It is 400 plus pages. So thank you for providing this for us today. But if anybody's interested in delving more into that, that is up on OLIS, as well as the PUC's solar report that Jason was talking about too. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, next, the panel with all the answers will be the Federal Clean Power Plan update, and we have Colin, Andy, and Jason again to come back up here. Welcome, gentlemen. There's a lot of gentlemen here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Colin McConaughey with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And to my left, Jason Eisdorfer, Public Utility Commission.
And Andy Ginsberg with the Oregon Department of Energy.
And I don't think we have all the answers to the previous panel's questions, but we are here just to share a brief update on our progress. Our three agencies are working closely together on EPA's Clean Power Plan and how to best implement that here in Oregon. As most of you hopefully recall, we gave a lengthy description of the Clean Power Plan and what it entails to this committee in a joint session with the Senate Natural Resources Committee toward the end of September. So I believe this is just a quick update on the progress that we've made since then, so over the past 6 weeks or so. I have a first slide here just recapping a few main points of the Clean Power Plan before we get that update underway. You probably recall that this is a federal regulation that EPA issued late this summer. In August, it seeks to reduce CO2 emissions from existing coal and natural gas power plants, and by EPA's estimates, it will reduce CO2 pollution nationwide across the energy sector by about 32% by 2030, when the ultimate emission reductions that EPA is requiring of states must be achieved. The rule focuses primarily on companies that own and operate these coal and gas power plants, but it does operate as a regulation a little differently than most Clean Air Act regulations that we see from EPA, insofar as it gives states very broad flexibility to determine the mechanisms we want to use that we think are best for our state for achieving the emission reductions that they're requiring of our state. So with that, just a quick overview, I'll get into some of the main points of progress that we've made, that our three agencies have made working with stakeholders over the past couple months. The first point of progress is, you may recall, in September we laid out a whole host of options, a large decision tree that showed the various options that EPA has given states. Again, they give us very broad flexibility to figure out how we want to reduce CO2 pollution from our coal and gas power plants. And I think the progress that we've made to date in working with our stakeholders is really to identify that before we get into a lot of those toggles that down the road, there's really one decision point that's fundamental that we need to work on right now in this early part of our state's planning process. And that is, what type of emission target do we want as a state to pursue? EPA gives states two quite different emission goals that we need to choose one of which to pursue in our state plan. The first of these emission goals is an emission rate target, meaning a carbon intensity target, if you will. It's expressed as pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour of generation. So a state's pursuing an emission rate target, apply an emission rate to each of the coal and gas power plants within the state, and those power plants have to either achieve that emission rate directly there at the facility or buy credits, essentially offset credits, to buy down their emission rate to achieve that rate. Alternatively, EPA says states can adopt what they call a mass cap, which is an overall ceiling on the total CO2 emissions that will be allowed from collectively from all of the coal and natural gas power plants there in the state. So this decision is really fundamental to states' planning processes. It really determines the subsequent decisions that we put in front of ourselves and also determines whether we can work with certain other states, because states that choose an emission rate cannot, for the most part, work with states that have a mass cap and vice versa. So this is a real important decision for us, and we've, in working with our stakeholders, determined that this really needs to be front and center in our planning process. And just a quick note, over the past couple months, I mentioned our stakeholder involvement. We've had well over a dozen meetings with smaller group stakeholder group meetings. More recently had a large stakeholder group meeting that comprised all the stakeholders in Oregon that have expressed interest in our clean power plan process. And that was a really fruitful process where our stakeholders were able to express their interests and concerns, not just to the agencies as they had in the small group meetings, but to one another, so that we were not continuing to serve as an intermediary between our stakeholder groups. And what we heard in the stakeholder outreach, both in the small group meetings and in this larger group meeting that we held late last month, was a variety of interests and concerns about how Oregon pursues our state plan to comply with EPA's regulation. And one of the continued requests, if you will, from stakeholders or inquiries was what state governments' priorities or principles might be as we look at all these options that EPA has put in front of us. And because we heard a wide range of interests and concerns, as you would expect from the diverse stakeholder group here in Oregon, we decided that the best path forward, and at least at this early point in our planning process, is rather than for the state to select what our principles will be right now at this early point, instead to develop a set of evaluation criteria that pretty much encapsulate those interests and concerns that we heard from stakeholders, sometimes from opposite angles, and do so in a neutral manner. And so what you see up in front of you are six different criteria that we think represent the range of interests and concerns we heard from stakeholders. These are phrased neutrally, so they're not value judgments. We've certainly heard value judgments around each of these areas. I don't think there's probably any surprises up here, given this committee's extensive experience hearing from stakeholders in Oregon and their interests and concerns around energy policy and greenhouse gas emissions. But what you see up there are criteria that we propose to use in our planning process, at least over the next year, in evaluating that fundamental decision about what type of emission target for Oregon works best. And I'm not going to walk through each of these criteria. They're draft right now, as you see it labeled there. We plan to revise this based on some input we've already received from stakeholders and issue it out for further review and comment in an attempt to get this nailed down, these criteria nailed down by the end of the year. And what you'll see here in this final slide is the process that we've developed with stakeholders for the next year, where you see in the first couple months there, the last couple months here of 2015, we're finalizing those evaluation criteria in preparation for an iterative process over the following 6 months or so throughout the winter and spring of 2016, where we are analyzing our compliance options and going through an iterative process with stakeholders before we begin to draft a report to EPA. EPA sets up the first deadline for states as September 6th of 2016, when states need to either develop a full and final plan and submit that to EPA, or develop a progress report and a request for an extension. And we think it's most likely at this point that we will be filing for that extension with a progress report in September of next year. We don't think we'll have worked out all the details of our plan with our stakeholders by that point. So what you see here is a process that whereby we are drafting and submitting that progress report to EPA at the latest in September of next year. And we fully expect to be continuing to brief this body and others in legislature throughout that process. You see, we expect to be to provide a briefing during session next February, as well as whenever the legislature reconvenes, as long as there is interest in hearing about our progress in this process. And with that, I will leave it there for questions.
Great questions. Representative
Holby. Thanks. In looking at that decision between the emission rate and the mass cap, I know there's been a lot of conversations about Oregon implementing a cap and trade or a cap and investment program, which may involve the exchange of credits with other states involved. And so do either one of these methods, either the emission rate or the mass cap, prevent or stand in the way of that kind of cap and trade system?
Yeah. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holby, that's a great question. I don't think either emission goal type it completely stands in the way of a cap and trade program, but a cap and trade program, as I understand it, is a mass based program. It is easy to imagine that a mass-based emission goal, were we to select that here for clean power plan compliance purposes, would dovetail more easily with a mass-based statewide cap-and-trade program.
Follow-up? And do you know where California is at in choosing between those two?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holby, not an up-to-the-day or even week knowledge, but a passing knowledge nonetheless that they expect to use their mass-based cap-and-trade program to achieve the reductions that are required of them by this plan.
Thanks.
Representative Dunford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you guys for your report. This is important stuff. Again, getting back to that conference in D.C., we did have a presentation from EPA there about the rule and so forth, and it's clear from their perspective that what the federal rule was to put in place was, in fact, a national cap-and-trade program when it comes to carbon-based coal and so forth as reported regarding the electrical grid. You know, there's a cap, and they anticipate states trading regionally to meet, again, to help the country, I'm talking nationally here, meet the unit requirements that they're looking for in terms of CO2 reductions. And again, it seems to me a bit redundant that we would be engaging at the state level and putting in place an additional cap and trade, if you will, that could be contrary or over and above or beyond or whatever. But the point being, in the eyes of the feds, as they put together the final rule, and again, flip forward, go back in reverse a year from in the past, and we were all wringing our hands wondering what this going to look like. Well, the final rule comes out, and it's not as problematic for us to achieve as some people feared and some of us feared, but yet it's not quite enough to some. They want to go beyond that. And I guess I'm just, you know, from DEQ's perspective, it's very difficult for you, obviously, to model what the impact of this would be, how we would implement that. And Jason, I'm going to look at you and the PUC in terms of costs, you know, as you took a look at the your evaluation criteria, the cost to energy suppliers, not just within the state under a cap and trade, cap and dividend, cap and invest, or again, doubling of the RPS. I mean, how do you guys factor in the cost again? As your, if your criteria is going to involve here, you know, cost to Oregon energy suppliers, how do you put all that into the crystal ball and give the consumers any kind of objective information that they can use and say, I'm in favor of this because I'm willing to pay this much more, or I'm not because I can't afford this much more? How are we going to be able to provide answers to consumers in this kind of evolving, shifting, you know, paradigm that we find ourselves in right now in Oregon?
Yeah. Chair Megan Peterson, Representative Johnson, another good question. And actually, I circle back to the start of your question, acknowledging that EPA really sees this as a regional, if not national, program potentially, if states coordinate our plans. And I think to get to the complex, the answers to the complex questions you're asking about cost, states are largely going to, or at least to some degree, going to be heavily reliant on a lot of the complex regional and national models that are very sophisticated, that, that typically states, certainly state DEQs, do not have experience running or contracting for. But there is a lot of national and regional attention on this rule, and a lot of tools that are being developed, and some of which have been developed, that are available to states to help run these different compliance scenarios. And a lot of the work using these models is running various scenarios. Well, what if we all the states in the West were to go mass-based or emission rate-based, or what if we didn't? What if we all went our own separate ways? What are the cost outcomes? What are the emissions outcomes? But I think the message I'm trying to convey is that these are complex questions that states are going to be reliant on external support to answer in many cases. And but I do see a lot of these tools being developed and a lot of the support structure beginning to develop regionally and nationally.
Chair Baker-Peterson, Representative Johnson. So this is a really interesting exercise. I think the work that the three agencies have done together, I think we've gotten good response from stakeholders, but the real beneficiary of our working together is ourselves, because there's a lot of moving pieces, as Representative Johnson just said. I mean, so for example, without having actually done the analysis and the math, I think sort of a back-of-the-envelope approach might indicate that for a particular utility and its ratepayers, a rate-based approach might be least cost. But that doesn't necessarily work on behalf of the other elements in the state, and in which case a mass-based for the whole state might be a better approach. So it's those kinds of things that I think we have to consider and weigh. We are working with utilities and their ability to do some of this analysis. We're working with the stakeholders who are bringing some of their scenarios that they would like to test to our analytical approach. And we're getting there. I think we're starting to really get some conceptual framework around how to move forward. But as Colin said, a lot of the cost production models are things that I know my staff, we just literally don't have that financial capability to do a cost production model. The utilities do, and some of the larger regional entities do. And so we will be relying on regional and some national analytical approaches.
If I could, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I was just going to add to what you're saying, Jason. I appreciate what you're saying. And there's a lot of unknown out there, a tremendous amount. But the irony is that, you know, we all may have that decision made about our future at the ballot box outside of your good wisdom and your knowledge as well.
Right.
And that's, I think, a daunting prospect as well. So thank you.
Representative Johnson, I was just going to add to what my colleague said, that another one of the moving pieces is what all the other states decide mm-hmm. to do. And the cost of, assuming that we enter into a multi-state type of arrangement, the cost of trading is going to be really dependent on how deep that market is, which means how many states participate in either a rate-based approach or a mass-based approach. So even if the analysis determined that one approach was better or worse for our state, if all the other states go a different way, that will change the economics of everything. So the updates that will all states are required to submit in September of 2016 should be pretty revealing. Many states will hopefully, if not commit to one path or another, at least indicate which direction they're leaning, and that could start helping the analysis move forward and help states come together decide what's going to happen in September of 2017.
Representative Holm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question that relates back to a question that Rep. Bentz raised last time, which was, who's the we here, right? And I think that for the time being, the governor's office has identified that this is their nut to crack with regard to the Clean Power Plan. Now, we've just heard the prior presentation by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council that sort of says what they think is going on from their federal responsibility as well. Where I think the we might come, meaning the legislature might come in again, is although I'm seeing some encouraging talk about how we meet these federal requirements or standards to reach a certain emissions level by a certain date, if we get to those federal goals, we still will not have met our state goals. And so that's our problem as a legislature, if we see that we're not meeting our climate change policies that we've already adopted. And so I just want to plant a seed here in that in the mechanisms that we're considering to meet the federal obligations, that we check back and say, is there additional capacity within those mechanisms to go ahead and meet our state standards too? Headroom, so to speak, or are we going to need additional and different mechanisms in combination to meet the state standards so that we don't get siloed up in thinking, well, we're going to solve the federal problem and we'll be done, because we won't. But we'll need to build off of that. And I hope that maybe not a question, sort of somewhere in between a comment and a musing, but I hope we don't lose sight of that.
Representative Bentz.
So this whole conversation reminds me of all of us getting together like a little ants and creating this incredibly complex anthill, and then China comes along and kicks it apart. And the argument is, if we don't build a little anthill with all the little constructs we're talking about, they won't. That's how the argument goes. And so to me, the question is, how much are we going to pay lawyers and people that measure things and lawsuits and litigation to create this massive system, one of which we must create because the federal government has now said we must, and now one we're going to impose upon ourselves here in Oregon. It would be helpful for me if we again could put a time frame on it. I was talking up here, do we have the lollygag approach or the hair on fire approach? Which is it? Because time plays such a huge part in what we're doing, or must, if this is so important that we're spending so much on it, why aren't we putting these metrics in place so we can go back to the people of Oregon and say, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it, this is how much it's costing. So the thing that bothers me the most as I listen to all this is, I remember, I just looked it up, it's French, it's the line that was built, the Maginot line, what was it, how do we say it?
Maginot.
Whatever that line was, it got built. It was perfectly worthless. Perfectly worthless. A lot of effort. And so one of the questions I was going to ask, and I thought, well, why bother, is when we're busy putting this meaningless cap in place, which we must, or the rate, what are the credits against it? We don't cut trees here anymore, but they do grow and sequester carbon. Do we get to take into account the fact that we aren't cutting trees, they are storing carbon, and we can take in the amount of time that they will store it? Because remember, they too will turn into carbon. But there is a time element. which I never hear about in all these conversations. So this is me expressing my frustration over what I see as a huge opportunity for lawyers and people who measure things. And a lot of debate, a lot of discussion, a lot of back and forth, a lot of feeling really good about ourselves, and I wonder how much we're really doing. So I'll be bringing a bill, as I did last time, asking for the metrics, which I've discussed with Palmer at length and with Representative Leininger. And all of you, because I think we brought that bill in here and talked about it. Mm-hmm. But I think it would, to the extent you guys can help us get some handle on this so we can at least tell the state of Oregon what we're doing and why, it would be very helpful to me when I go back to my district. Comment if you like. But if you, it would be nice, I would love to have the answer to my time question. Should we be in a huge hurry, and if so, why?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Vence, I think I will just take that last one. The time question in this context, the Clean Power Plan, is, like, I think as you alluded to, made for us by the EPA. They have set time frames. I would note that in the context of time frame, EPA does give states, does allow states to bank actions that achieve greater than compliance, to reduce emissions below what was required in early years. So in 2022, 23, 24, et cetera, if states are overachieving in their emission reductions, they can bank those emission reductions and use those later on. So there is at least some, this is just to say there's some small measure of acknowledgement that earlier actions are worth more than later actions. But that certainly does not get to your broader questions. Jason Wells.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Vence. Now don't get mad or anything. I actually do want to try to make you feel a little bit better about something. What I want to try to make you feel better about is that you live in this state, and it's this state that's trying to comply. This is one of the better states to be in right now in terms of attempting to comply with the Clean Power Plan. The investments that we have made in the past really, really have made this easier for us. The decision to close the Boardman plant is a huge advance forward. So there are, I would say, most other states we would be, and in fact, as Representative Johnson said, if the proposed plan had come out the way it looked, it was proposed, that was going to be an issue. The final plan, whether rate-based or mass-based, would take advantage of some of the policies that you all have adopted. And makes compliance significantly easier. So I don't want to promise that this is going to be easy, and there will be a lot of different voices with different policy goals ultimately. But this is doable in this state. We have more tools and are further down the road than most. And I don't know if that's worth a lot to you, but it should be worth something, I hope.
Representative Vence.
Thank you. Okay, so I appreciate the answer, and I've had that explanation before, and I understand it. Here's the fallacy of it. It's that people immediately think that that type of compliance, inexpensive as you've just explained it will be, mm-hmm. is somehow the answer. It's not the answer. The answer is figuring out how to go to China with the answer. And what I fear is that the solutions that, if we do it, they will, is not the solution at all. And I've suggested in other conversations, you've heard it before, that Bill Gates has probably the best take on it, and you can read about it in the Atlantic magazine. And his take was, we got to go do the research necessary to find the answer because we don't have it yet, and all of this isn't. And so my thought on this is, thank God it isn't going to cost us very much. And whether or not all those things we've done in the past, when added together, it would exceed or less than the cost it would have been now, I have no clue, because we haven't measured it. And so, yay for that previous investment. How much was it? Don't know. How much of a burden on our economy? Don't know. At the end of the day, is it going to save the world? Unlikely. So what I fear is we're going to run around building our little anthill and we're not doing the correct thing to solve the problem. That's my fear. And I base that on basically three or four different very smart people's analyses. But I'd like to hear yours.
Chair Peterson. Actually, I will, Representative Benz, I will say I don't think there is an answer. I think there are a lot of pieces to the answer. And we are doing our pieces. And so it's maybe just a different way of sort of looking at the equation.
Representative Johnson.
Are we time constrained, Madam Chair?
We are not.
Okay. Well, this won't be
last. But you may make it the reception.
I know that. So I just wanted to thank you for your indulgence. But Jason, I really appreciated you bringing that up because I think in a rational, I'll use the word responsible. Maybe that's too strong. But in a world where we share the same values of wanting to be as environmentally responsible as you possibly can in the most cost-effective way, your comments make sense. I.e., we can reach the rule, and Oregon's in relatively good position because we were given credit for good behavior in the past, which is great. But the problem we run into, as I said earlier, is there are some individuals and groups for whom that's not enough, that they want to go above and beyond that. And that's the unknown that I think nobody can quantify what that would entail, what the cost would be, what the long-term impact would be on ratepayers and on our economy in the state. So that's that unknown that I think a lot of us are afraid of, because, yes, we can lay out a pathway, a glide path to accomplish the rules as the feds have put them upon us. So going beyond that, that's where it gets to be a little bit queasy, and it makes me nervous, and I think a lot of other people, because that decision may be made outside of that rational, reasonable conversation that we're all having here today.
Representative Britton.
I think we're getting possibly into the philosophical end of the discussion, and hopefully this meeting draws to a close soon. But I've been pretty quiet, kind of dozing off over here. I think, at some point, I just have to get philosophical and say that the forests are on fire, we have the snow caps gone away, the oceans are acidified, our lives are being affected today. So I accept that. You may or may not, anybody else, but I accept that. I want to figure out, in our little anthill here, I'd like to apply resources, I'd like to find the answers here, mm-hmm. and I'd like to do that working with our universities.
Yep.
And then I'd like to sell that to China.
Absolutely.
And I think that's kind of the direction I want to go. I mean, that's just about as simple as I can make it. And that's, but what I, my question, there is a question here. So I've gotten confused. And I think, and Representative Helms kind of clued me in, was confused. So I know what you guys are chartered to do. You do the Clean Power Plan work. What are we doing in terms of the responding to the Global Warming Commission's greenhouse gas report that we heard last month? So they have this whole different set of goals, and so I don't know what we're doing here. Do we have an action plan, or are we just kind of watching what's going on? Would somebody remind me how does that fit into what we're doing here?
I think what we have is we've got a federal mandate to follow the Clean Power Plan that the state is working on, and that is something that we have to comply with. But it does not stop us as a state from putting together what we want our own plan to be, just in terms of emissions and policies. And I think one of the things that, as we're having the larger discussion around climate, is that, and the question about rate-based or mass-based, is how well is that incorporated with any kind of program that we might want to implement, like cap and trade or cap and invest, that could be not just a state but a regional plan. And what's the ease? I mean, that was the last one, connection with other policies that people were looking at. I think some of the best example of why we need to continue to have that conversation at the state is both that this is something that only affects the energy industry, and there's other, mm-hmm. There's other carbon emitters in our state that right. we definitely need to look at. And the second thing is that outside or absent of any kind of federal mandate, we went ahead with some reductions of the renewable portfolio standards and other things that have actually put us in a great position for when the federal, these federal guidelines come down. And that was something that we decided to do as a state ourselves. So I think that this is great, and we're gonna comply, and people are working hard at this. But this does not limit what we can do, as a legislative body.
Just one part of the overall issue that we're trying to address.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the reminder.
You're welcome.
I just set that up. I give you the question so you could share that.
I have a question about the process, the 2016 process. It looks like there's a lot of evaluation of criteria, where are the decision points? Like, do you have, you need to have a decision made by X date?
Chair Baker-Peterson, that's a good point. There are not clear decision points indicated there out through 2016, in part because there are not very many decisions that EPA requires of states in that time period. Andy mentioned that what EPA is hoping for, and I think a lot of states are hoping for as well, is that states take that initial progress report that's due in September of next year and take that as an opportunity to either commit or say fairly strongly that we prefer one or the other rate or mass, so that we can all coordinate our decisions around knowing what approach each state will take. But there are really a few decisions that need to be made in this first year if we seek the extension. EPA does require more firm commitment to a particular approach in September of 2017, and then ultimately the final decision on the plan entirely is due September of 2018.
Yeah. Great. Thank you all very much for the update, and we'll look forward to hearing from you again in February on how this is going.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting and close the interim meeting of the House Energy and Environment. Oh, wait, actually, I don't want to do that yet. Hold, please. Just a reminder to everybody that the 24th, next Tuesday, is the deadline to submit bill drafts. So we'll be having some committee bills as well as, I'm sure, everybody has individual bills. We'll next get together January 13th through 15th for those days. And at that time, I'd like to have some time set aside for folks to talk about any of the bills that they're going to have that are related to energy and environment. So just keep that in mind. All right. Anything else for the good of the order? All right. Thank you. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the session. Thank you, Dan. Go ahead and close the session.